Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and with me today is Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin. It's time for Q&A with Layla. In our part one, we got a question from a woman who's concerned about taking Arimidex for prevention of recurrence of breast cancer. She had breast cancer, successfully treated, but they wanted to give her hormone blockade treatment with Arimidex as a precaution. And we discussed the pros and cons of that. But a more important question in my mind is what can be done for active prevention of breast cancer recurrence? And this is something that we really like to do with women at the Hoffman Center. So what are some of the elements of that?
Well, first of all, because cancer loves sugar, you want to be on the right diet. You want to keep sugars to an absolute minimum. Even high sugar fruits like bananas, grapes, you don't want to have them too often. Juices, smoothies, all of that. But other very, very important supplements like DIM, like Broccomax, DIM can help with the hormonal issue that maybe the Arimidex is there to take care of. So maybe DIM would be helpful. We like Prevail. We like flax lignans to carry out any excess hormone that may be troublesome for a recurrent cancer. The Broccomax, the sulforaphanes, are very important for cancer prevention. Melatonin. Now, melatonin and another part of our prevention program would be to look at sleep cycles because you want to make sure you're getting enough sleep, believe it or not.
Right, that is important.
Yeah. There are higher cancer rates in shift workers, people who work all night and sleep all day.
There are also higher cancer rates in, this just came in a study, where if you have a little bit of ambient light in your room from, say, a nightlight or from incomplete blackout shades if you sleep through the morning, you actually may somewhat increase your risk of breast cancer. Basically what that does is it, even if you're sleeping, it reduces your production of melatonin. Fascinating new information about the effects of light.
Yeah. Now, in our cancer patients, normally we give melatonin, not the 3 to 5 milligram to go to sleep, but a 20 milligram for its antioxidant potential. It's probably one of the most important antioxidants for cancer prevention.
Mm-hmm.
We like AHCC. The mushrooms, very, very popular in Europe.
Empower is the brand name
Empower.
We use, yeah. Used in Japan, used on virtually every cancer patient. It is the leading nutritional supplement in Japan, and the government actually will reimburse patients who use this once they have cancer. It's prescribed by conventional doctors. They say, hey, use it because it's effective.
Wow. Some other antioxidants, certainly your selenium, your vitamin C. I think vitamin E is a very good idea. I think also for the hormonal issue, maybe calcium D-glucarate.
Yes,
as well.
That helps.
I mean,
too.
you would almost treat the 73-year-old woman as somebody with a little estrogen dominance or something, possibly.
Yep, in a similar way, right?
Yeah.
Vitamin D plays a role in. Did you mention that?
Yes.
Yeah. Vitamin D.
No,
is,
I didn't. Vitamin D. Absolutely.
It does reduce the risk of breast cancer recurrence. Omega-3 fatty acids have been shown to be helpful, so we want to make sure that you get adequate amounts of that. And, what are some, I think there's some evidence on resveratrol.
Yes.
And then the soy issue is controversial because some people are afraid that soy is pro-estrogenic. There is mostly the information suggests that soy is okay and maybe a little bit protective. I kind of look forward to the day when we have more genetic tests available to us that give us the heads up on whether certain supplements or things like soy are beneficial or well-tolerated in different subgroups of women with breast cancer, because not all women with breast cancer are alike. You know, on the diet controversy, actually they had a study recently that was alarming that said that red meat increases the risk of breast cancer. But in that study, they did not distinguish between the poor quality red meat that is laced with hormones and laced with additives versus red meat that might be, as you mentioned in the first podcast, grass-fed.
Yeah.
But at the
Did they also include processed meats in the study too?
Red meat just was an aggregate. They didn't break it out. But the very self-same week, they came up with a very interesting study that shows that IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor 1, there are receptors for IGF-1 in some breast cancers, not all. So this is actually where the genetic testing comes in. In women who have receptors for IGF-1 in their breast cancer tissue, the higher the carbohydrate intake, the more they're going to get recurrence. So, I mean, so what this may argue for is that, well, not all women have to curtail their carbohydrates, perhaps if they don't have this IGF-1 receptor, but, you know, this is a fairly prevalent receptor, and that is kind of argues not so much against the use of red meat, but against the use of sugary carbohydrates, pasta, and so on. In one big study in Italy, they found no problems with meat, with fish, with chicken. They did find problems with pasta consumption, which it's lousy if you're from Italy.
And for those who don't, IGF-1 is insulin-like growth factor 1. Insulin-like growth factor being a growth type of hormone, we find a lot of the insulinogenic foods. If you're on a very high insulinogenic diet, that could mean a lot of dairy, could mean a lot of carbohydrates, even the whole grains. If you have a tendency towards some insulin resistance, it's possible that you have too much IGF or IGF-1, and that's what needs to be reduced there.
Right.
So that's very interesting to see who has that type, who doesn't, and I wonder if it would even correspond to the phenotype of a woman who's insulin resistant,
more
trunk fat or something.
Yeah. I mean, that's actually one of the reasons, you know, sometimes when we try to decide, you know, who should get a glucose tolerance test in our practice, we sometimes we'll say, oh, you know, the person has cancer, we know that already. I mean, obviously this is not a blood sugar problem. No, it could be a blood sugar problem.
That's right.
They're producing excess insulin on their glucose tolerance test, they're going to say, oh, I don't care about diabetes, heart disease. My cancer is my concern. Yeah, but if you're producing excess insulin, that might promote the IGF-1, which is a growth factor. It's like putting kerosene on the fire of cancer. So, all right. So I think that's a good basic discussion. You can get individualized care for that through a nutritionally oriented physician or a nutritionally oriented dietitian like Layla, because there I really love to work with women after a breast cancer diagnosis to put them, because it can be a real life-changing experience. You follow a diet that will help prevent breast cancer, but not only that, it'll make you live longer overall and live better.
That's true. That's true. That's right. What are some of the qualities of centenarians? They have high HDL, low triglycerides, and low fasting insulin.
Right.
Low fasting insulin.
And let's not forget the role of exercise, because walk for the cure, run for the cure, there really is something to it. It's not just wishful thinking that women who exercise after diagnosis of breast cancer have a far better prognosis. It's not like it, I mean, look, let's face it, there's some women who exercise like crazy, they still get a recurrence, but you have a lower risk. Okay.
Exercise is like taking metformin. Exercise makes our cells more sensitive to insulin. Being able to use the blood sugar properly, that's exactly what you want, and that's one of the benefits exercise gives us. Just one of the benefits for exercise. I do want to mention, Dr. Hoffman, that you know, an IV drip of vitamin C, I think, would also benefit.
Yeah, and this would K. this is really the whole different area. We've had podcasts with Dr. Jeannie Drisco on the use of intravenous vitamin C for cancer. This, I think, would be helpful and depends on how proactive you want to be. In this case, probably less likelihood of a recurrence. If you want to be proactive, take intravenous vitamin C. But for our women who are high risk of recurrence, we recommend it highly. Very high doses of vitamin C can be given intravenously. That cannot be given orally, and it has a different effect when given intravenously. We're talking 50, 75 as much. We have one patient getting 110 grams intravenously with prostate cancer. He's with metastatic prostate cancer. He's been controlled for, what, 5-6 years now. It's great.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
I have a question from Phil, the indomitable Phil, which we shout out to Phil because he's a patient, but he just spotted an article in Mind Body Green. That's a publication that I write for that talks about salmon in rather alarming terms. And, you know, let me just preface this by saying I love Mind Body Green, but the bias of Mind Body Green is towards a vegan diet. There's somehow, although I have managed to place articles there that suggest that it may be okay to eat some animal protein, but I have to say that they poured a lot of hate on me.
Oh boy!
Some of these vegans, they're so angry and hateful that even to suggest that you could use animal protein, they just get really angry and they post very negative comments on the Mind Body Green site. Although I did get a lot of support, but on the end, I found it's like, what's the big deal? I'm saying, I just reported the facts about a study that said that that a vegan diet is not necessarily the sine qua non of longevity and cancer prevention, and I critiqued the China study in one of my articles for Mind Body Green, and it was like, oh, how could you possibly say that? You're propaganda. It was like heresy. Anyway.
The China study was debunked many times over, and you were one of the people who debunked it.
Yeah.
All the cherry-picked research and so forth, and,
Okay, so now we have something. It's called, Five Reasons You Should Stop Eating Salmon, which I think is really doing the audience a disservice. But here's what they say. The guy who posted this article wrote a book called Meatonomics.
Meatonomics.
Now, I don't know the book, but I predict it's kind of a diatribe against our use of animal protein in America. And it's probably a vegan or vegetarian tract. And it says the book explores the hidden forces at play in Americans' high levels of consumption of fish and other animal foods. Salmon is particularly troubling because research shows that our obsession with this and other fish is causing catastrophic declines in marine ecosystems. Well, I feel bad for marine ecosystems, but I also believe that I believe in sustainable agriculture and sustainable aquaculture, and I think that salmon is actually one of the most healthy things you can consume. But here's what they say. Salmon's health benefits are a fish story. Okay, well, they quote nutritionist John McDougall. Well, we know where he's coming from. He's a vegan. Yep. He's a vegan guy. So he says, salmon is half fat, and eating it increases the risk of obesity and type 2 diabetes. Well, that's not been demonstrated.
That's just out and out false.
He's just thinking because it's got some fat in it that he's already decided that fat is bad. And he says, ounce for ounce, salmon contains just as much cholesterol as hamburger. Well, so what? What if it does? I'm not even sure it does.
That's 1975. Come on.
So that's not an argument. That's not an argument. Also, research finds fish-based omega-3s inhibit the action of insulin. That's not true.
No.
So, another study shows fish-derived omega-3s greatly increase the volume of colon cancer metastases. Really?
I don't think so.
The opposite is that actually, okay. Also, fish's highly acidic flesh speeds calcium loss. What about that one? It's too acidic.
Oh, stop. No.
Too much protein.
Nature gave us, acidic food and alkalizing food. Mm-hmm. Eating fish isn't going to make you too acidic, and eating produce makes us a little more alkaline anyway. There are also dangers. People think being alkaline is a good thing, not necessarily.
Yeah.
There are dangers to being too alkaline.
Yep, I agree.
So,
okay. Having been there myself, when I was on a vegetarian diet, I was too alkaline. I became super allergic, itchy skin, and, hives, and, very, very super sensitive. I had to include some animal protein and fat in my diet. Okay, argument number two. They talk about farm-raised salmon. And there I have to agree. I am concerned about unhealthy levels of contaminants like PCBs, dioxins. So the issue there is, and this is a bit of a dilemma with salmon, is that I think it's best to get ocean-raised salmon. Now, that it becomes very expensive, and that is sort of an elitist proposition, because if you check the price of, coho salmon and so on, where do you get your salmon? You actually found a way.
I get it frozen, and I get it from Trader Joe's.
Right.
And they offer the sockeye salmon, coho, silver bright, and king salmon.
And that's not
all
farmed.
It's not farmed. It's wild Alaskan salmon, all of it. Otherwise, I wouldn't buy it.
Right.
And it's all somewhere between $8.99 and $10.99 a pound, depending on which salmon you're getting.
And that's within reach. That's within reach.
Yeah, I could stock up my freezer with $80 worth of salmon my husband and I will eat for the next 2 or 3 weeks.
Okay, so then they also cite the, environmental arguments. They say salmon for the people means less for the animals. They talk about wild salmon is struggling because of overfishing, and so you know, they're saying it's causing populations of bears, orcas, and eagles to die off. Well, I really feel terrible for the bears, orcas, and eagles, and I think there needs to be some environmental regulation around the fisheries.
We need safe farming practices.
Yeah.
What needs to happen is safe farming practices.
But I have to say, I think the industry is concerned about that because, you know, they don't want to just, you know, slash
and burn. We don't
want
to deplete all the wild salmon.
Yeah, because then it's going to be bad for them. I think they have marine biologists studying this. They kind of figure how much can they harvest without completely devastating the salmon and so on and so on. You know, so mm-hmm. I mean, look, maybe I gotta say, I mean, I don't trust the industry entirely. I think there needs to be environmental regulation and inspection and so on. All right,
there's a good website for that for people who want environmentalworkinggroup.org. That's EWG.org. So you could read more about that.
So they say, looking for omega-3s, try cholesterol-free plant sources like flax, hemp, soy, and walnuts.
Mm. Well, those are all good sources, but, you know, 70% of us lack the enzyme to change over to the essential fatty acids that we need. Fish is actually still the best source. If you want a vegetarian formula, you could get from algae.
Yeah, you can get the DHA. Yeah. But, I mean, look, for ethical vegetarians, do what you want to do. That may be your personal choice. But from a health standpoint, I can't tell you that salmon is bad for you. He says almost like it's like a vice. He says, with a little willpower, you can dump salmon. That's kind of like, you know, stop smoking, you know, stop doing those tequila shots and get rid of salmon because it's bad for you. This is a bad message. Unfortunately, a lot of uncritical people, although, you know, very intelligent people, but without scientific expertise or scientific literature, you're going to read this and they're going to say, oh, salmon's bad for you because now I read it in Mind Body Green, popular website.
That's
not good.
Bad.
All right, maybe I'll write it. Maybe I'll try and write an article that pushes back on that because they're open to debate. I'll just have a lot of people will hate on me for doing it.
That's okay. You're sending a very important message. You know,
we're here
to educate too. So
yeah.
Okay.
You know, I don't hate on vegetarians.
Okay. No, and nor do I. And that's just not the way to be.
Right.
Do we have time for another question?
We do indeed.
Great. This one comes from Rachel. Hi, Dr. Hoffman. I'm 38 years old. 2 years ago, I tore my calf muscle, 60% tear playing netball, which is an Australian game similar to basketball.
By the way, this is amazing because we have so many listeners in Australia.
They're
picking up our podcast via some kind of Oz podcast, OZ. You know, it's not, the in Australia, Oz is not about Dr. Oz. It's a short for Australia. And for some reason, they just love this type of information. So a shout out to all our Australian listeners. Yeah. I hope you understand my poorly accented English, American accented. You know, it's probably pretty unpleasant for you to listen to. But you can.
Good day, mate.
Yeah. Good day. But anyway, go ahead.
So Rachel tore her calf muscle 60% playing netball. And then she says, I further developed a clot in the muscle, not a deep vein clot. I take chiolic olive leaf extract and a good multi. My husband, also 38 years old, has recently torn his bicep muscles at the shoulder boxing training. He's also a self-employed
plaster. Active Aussies there.
Yeah. Surgery, however, for him is required. I'm wondering if any supplements can assist us both. And I listened to your podcast from Australia. Great show.
That's excellent. Okay, yeah. So, you know, things that help injuries, I would suggest something like Wobenzyme, which is a combination of proteolytic enzymes, and bromelain, which is really, really good for sports injuries, inflammation. Topically, you might try something called Toprasin. Toprasin is a homeopathic topical product that you, at various times, they've been a sponsor of Intelligent Medicine. You can use the things that are helpful for inflammation, but if you actually have a physical tear, inflammation is only going to be part of that. For repair.
And for the clot in the muscle.
Oh, yeah. Oh, here's the, yeah. Actually, we have some very interesting cases with that. One of my most faithful patients, and she's very memorable because she comes in on a seaplane. You know, she says, I'm here in New York. It's like, where are you? It's like, I'm just getting off my seaplane. She flies in from, another part of the country. and lands in the Hudson. She had a blood clot in her leg, and it was terrible. It was painful. It was swollen. And we put her on something like a proteolytic enzyme, Wobenzyme. Natokinase would be helpful, too, because that's a bit of a clot buster. Lots of omega-3 fatty acids. And miracle of miracles, it went away. I mean, never to return. And she had had years of discomfort, and they said, well, you're going to have to learn to live with it. They said, you got to wear suppos for the rest of your life, or, tape your calf because wear support stocking.
Oh.
And she doesn't have to do it anymore.
No, the power of enzymes and supplements. That's wonderful.
Yeah, that can be very helpful. So I would go down that pathway. And, that can make a difference. By the way, this is a little bit on a tangent, but a lot of people have, quote, rotator cuff tears, a lot of, like, shoulder problems. They just did a study where first thing that people want is they want an MRI. They say, my shoulder hurts, I want an MRI. Okay, then they do the MRI, and they say, you got a tear. It's like, okay, well, what do you do? Oh, if you have a tear, go for surgery and repair it, right?
Uh-huh.
Well, what they discovered is that just as with back problems, you complain of back problems and you do an MRI, you could have the most horrible looking back in the world and have no pain. Or alternatively, you could have, something that looks fine and you could be in excruciating pain. There's actually a big disconnect between the appearance on MRI in back problems and shoulder problems and the actual degree of discomfort. So
Not a great diagnostic tool then? Or
right. The moral of the story is maybe we should not be so quick to do MRIs, because MRIs lead us to believe that there's a repairable tear. We probably do too much surgery. For back problems, sometimes you get quick relief, but long term, it's a very questionable value. And similarly, unlike knee problems somewhat respond pretty well sometimes to arthroscopic surgery. The shoulder is a very quirky joint. And the outcomes of rotator cuff surgeries, I've had friends who've undertaken patients, and, they're not entirely happy. So sometimes the right course is some good physical therapy. Be patient with it.
Physical therapy is wonderful.
Yeah, the right kind of physical therapy.
Yes.
To strengthen your shoulder girdle, and take some of those anti-inflammatory nutrients and be patient with it. And, as a last resort, get surgery. But if you immediately get an MRI, they're going to go up, boom, it's torn, we're going to repair it for you. Well, maybe not so fast.
Yeah.
There's also the alternative of using platelet-rich plasma, PRP, and stem cells. I don't do that therapy, but some people say it really works great. And there will be advances in that field eventually.
Yeah. Okay.
Anything else?
Best of luck to Rachel. We have another question. Yes.
Yeah, we have time for a quick question.
Great. This comes from Joan. Dear Dr. Hoffman, I have lymphedema for a few years in my legs and have been told by several doctors that I didn't have it. I took the bull by the horns and found a place that treats it after my podiatrist told me to do so. I was seen by an OD and had treatment. She might mean DO. I don't know. I've never heard of OD.
An OD is an optometrist. Actually, so she probably was seen by a DO.
Oh, a DO. Okay, good.
Yeah, there really is such a thing as an OD. That's an optometrist. But I don't think she was seen by an optometrist.
Yeah. Well, get this. She says, I take no medication, just vitamins, and I wanted to clean out my liver and got milk thistle. Why does everybody first want a detox? Okay, anyway, after a week or two, my legs swelled up terribly. And I went back to the store where I bought it, and she told me I should not have taken it with lymphedema. Hmm. Well, Joan, you don't want to take your advice from just anybody who works in a store.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to find somebody that can help me. I'm very, very tired with swollen feet.
Okay. So actually the best book on this subject, and I remember even in the early days, 25 years ago when I was just starting this program, it was called Health Talk then, I interviewed a lady named Joan Swirsky, Swirsky. And she wrote a great book called Coping with Lymphedema. And in that book, she mostly talks about physical therapy for lymphedema, which in those days was very, very hard to find. Very few people were doing it. More and more, there are specialists who do physical therapy for lymphedema, the right types of exercises and the right types of wraps and supports that help to drain the area that's swollen. And these days, to a lesser extent, because in the old days they used to do these radical mastectomies, which left women with very, very swollen hands, you know, like catcher's mitts. Now they're much more careful about cutting the lymphatics and, you know, taking out too many lymph nodes, which cause a block up of fluid. But people can get lymphedema from a hereditary cause, or they can get it due to vein problems. And so the book talks about the right kind of physical therapy, but it also mentions that what really helps with swelling, bioflavonoids. And we have some nice bioflavonoid products now, you know, rutin, roxarutin. They're in the Gero product, which is the, what is it called,
Venus PF.
Venus PF, yeah, I think that's right. Which is a Gero product that's available over the counter. Other companies make powerful bioflavonoids. And the other one that's helpful is horse chestnut. Horse chestnut used for lower extremity swelling in Europe a lot. It's actually an Austrian product, I believe, but it's used throughout Europe for swollen feet and ankles. And it, in some studies, compared toe-to-toe, so to speak, with elastic stockings. It works as well as elastic stockings. You like that, a toe-to-toe comparison? I mean, right? But, you know, the bioflavonoids, what they do is, you remember from your nutrition studies, bioflavonoids used to be called substance P or vitamin P in the old days. The bioflavonoids were referred to that as substance P. And the P stood for permeability. So what the bioflavonoids do is they reduce capillary leakage from the blood vessels into the surrounding tissue. And under pressure, that's what happens. And you can actually keep away some of that swelling and leakage with the bioflavonoids.
Excellent. Yeah.
So there's some strategies you can use. So the book is Coping with Lymphedema.
Yeah.
All right. So that just about wraps it up for this week. So you headed for the beach this weekend?
Actually, I was at the beach last. As a matter of fact, this weekend I am. Yes.
Oh, okay, good.
Yes. Hopefully, we're going to have nice weather.
Yeah. No, it should be. Yeah. I mean, part of the. I think a couple of days there might be a little cloudiness, but hey,
it's okay. It's still great to be out there. It's
absolutely.
Great to be out
east. All right. So we wish you all a great summer weekend, and we hope that you take the time to listen to our podcast. Also, in our newsletter this week, Layla has a nice article. What's it about?
Oh, it's about more on heart disease and the dangers of oxidized LDL.
Okay, which is one of the things we test for at the Hoffman Center. Not many doctors do, but we think it's ultra important. We had a great case of a patient the other day who came in with a very dangerously high oxidized LDL, and by dint of his great compliance with our dietary recommendations and by taking a lot of supplements, he's managed to reduce that oxidized LDL to acceptable levels. So I was getting a little frustrated because it was going down. It wasn't going down fast enough. Finally, at this last visit, it was perfect. It was just fine. Yeah. So that we really can work with that problem. And I wrote this week, actually, I wrote a little bit of a rah-rah story about one of our Hoffman Center employees. She's the gal who will take your vitamin orders if you call or if you email. She is Grimaldi
yes.
Vargas, who we're very proud of because she completed the Spartan race, and we're going to tell you all about it in the newsletter this week. So sign up for the Hoffman Center newsletter or go to
Go Grimaldi!
Grimaldi. She's amazing. She went from, when she first started working for us, who'd have thunk that she would have been able to do a Spartan race? Unbelievable.
Yeah.
She's our hero this week.
She's come a long way,
Yes, she has. Great. Okay, so thanks for joining us. And thank you, Layla. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.